Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today it's my great good fortune to have Salman Rushdie here to talk about his book, Shalimar the Clown. I wish it were possible to say that Salman Rushdie needs no introduction, but he does need an introduction as an author, as a public figure. Certainly he is well known, but his novels are Shalimar the Clown, the most recent, and in reverse order, Fury, The Ground Beneath Her Feet, The Moor's Last Sigh, East-West, Haroon in the Sea of Stories, The Satanic Verses, Shame, Midnight's Children, and Grimus. I've been reading Midnight's Children again, which won the Booker of Bookers, and to my enormous pleasure, I do think it's one of the books that defines the last 100 years of reading. It's really a spectacular novel. The new novel, Shalimar the Clown, I think is perhaps the best of his more recent books, but it is as a chronicler that I wish to speak to Salman Rushdie. This book seems to focus on Kashmir, which mm-hmm. is your family's birthplace, and a place described as a paradise to the young woman we meet in the first chapter, who has never in fact been there, but has learned to identify Kashmir with paradise. What is it that makes Kashmir a paradise?
What is it that made it a paradise? Because I think you wouldn't, now it's a broken paradise. I think it's something to do, first of all, with physical beauty. It's probably the most beautiful place that anyone will ever see who goes there. I've certainly not seen anywhere more beautiful myself. And something about that has to do with the curious juxtaposition of something very small, which is the valley, with things very large, which are the Himalayas. And the valley is very lush. It's very green, unlike a lot of India, which is brown. It's carpeted in saffron fields and flower meadows and little running streams and honeybees and fruit orchards and so on, and lakes, you know, wonderful glassy lakes everywhere. And around this tiny valley are these gigantic mountains. And has always been, you know, the Indian movies always used to use Kashmir whenever they wanted a kind of beautiful backdrop for a song number. now they can't because of the violence. They have to go elsewhere. But there's something paralleling that, which I suppose the simplest way of describing it would be a kind of human beauty. Kashmiris are very gentle people. And in the way that, you know, in a country the size of India, one people from one part of the country makes rude jokes about people from other parts of the country. The rude jokes about Kashmiris were all about their peacefulness, which was translated into cowardice by the more martial peoples of India. And it's one of the bitter ironies of history that this place, which was synonymous with peacefulness, should now be synonymous with violence. You know,
now, to some extent, Midnight's Children speaks of the birth of a baby who was born at the moment that the independence of India is created. And for him, at least, in his own perception of his magic, his life is synonymous with the history of India. This book is asking us to see that despite the fact that the story of this book might be read as an allegory, a political allegory of a crumbled paradise, its motions are in fact private and personal.
Yes.
That is to say that behind politics can be concealed private passion, and that once again we will not see the political as the personal, unless we are wearing the right pair of glasses.
Yeah, I think that's right. These figures the characters in this novel are not primarily designed as allegorical figures. You know, and they're designed as flesh and blood. You know, and it is true that like the narrator, like Salim, the narrator of Midnight's Children, the central Kashmiri couple, the young lovers whose story is at the heart of the book, they're also born in 1947. So you know, they're not born at the moment of midnight, you know, because that's the other novel. but they are also creatures of that moment of partition, you know, the sundering of India and Pakistan, out of which the history of the last 60 years of South Asia has come. In Kashmir, that meant something different. That beginning created a different rift, you know, whose consequences are still being worked out, because India and Pakistan both wanted it. But my desire was to make people who were people in this book, that, you know, and yes, their personal story is wound up with the story of the history of their place, you know, but they are, I'm trying to tell a story about particular people.
But one Hindu, one Muslim, their fathers are capable of meeting, and even a special meeting of the group of elders that govern is called, and it's determined, in fact, that not only can they marry, but that a marriage ceremony can be devised which will accommodate all of the necessary traditions. And even though individual family members may cavil at the presence of meat or at the absence of this or that aspect of the bridal gown, there is the possibility, seamlessly displayed, that these people can invent harmony, mm-hmm. that the rest of the book almost shows us that the outside world enters and displaces a whole community's will to get along.
Yeah. They're kind of, I mean, it has to be said that this is quite a naughty young couple. I mean, so they come from this village of traveling players. He's a clown, she's a dancer. And they are highly sexual young people, and they desire each other like crazy. And so they consummate their love when they're, I'm sorry to say, not quite 15. And yet, in spite of the very unconventional nature of that union, which is compounded by the fact that one of them is Hindu and the other is Muslim, which even in Kashmir would be an issue. In spite of all that, when their relationship comes to light, the village decides, and this is an important thought in the novel, that what unites them is greater than what divides them, and that their joint Kashmiriness, you know, is more important than their confessional differences, and therefore the rest of it must be accommodated, because as the village elders say, you know, they're good kids, they love each other, we've got to find a way to let them be together, you know, and that simple civilized decision, you know, is something which in the world seems to get harder and harder. But at that point is a decision that is made. And I think it's, you know, the book at that point, I have to say, probably pushes reality, the envelope of reality, a little bit towards fable. You know, the idea that a Hindu family and a Muslim family would devise a joint wedding ceremony is probably pushing it, you know, but I think it works, you know, as a metaphor of that feeling of togetherness that was genuine.
And not only that, it seems to be saying that divisiveness and difference are in fact ordinary parts of the world. It is not unusual for the man who is a cook in a neighboring village to feel anger that suddenly his neighbors are trying to become caterers as well as performing.
That's right.
Yes, that anger is understood and it needs to be worked out. The book has that question of what is the tinderbox? Mm-hmm. What is a difference that is not within the realm of usual human difficulty that takes things beyond the point of the acceptable?
Yeah. And what happens in the novel is that the world of Shalimar the Clown is shattered, not through his agency. You know, I mean, this is in a way a young man who, at quite an early age, has most of what he wants. You know, I mean, he has the girl he loves, and she loves him, and he works in this troupe of traveling players. He loves the work. He's very good at it. You know, he's a tightrope walker. He's a clown. He's able to combine the two things, and he's talented and admired. You know, and he has more or less everything he needs. You know, and then what happens is that world is brutally ruptured, and the first and biggest rupture is emotional. Because this wife, the girl he loves and is all he ever wanted, betrays him because of her ambitions for herself. She runs off. She's given a moment, you know, as it sometimes comes to people, a very limited horizon. A window opens in the universe, and the window is that she performs, the troupe performs for the visiting American ambassador, Ambassador Maximilian Ophuls. And he is a bit of a rogue. I mean, not a bit of a rogue. He's a rogue. I mean, he's sexually predatory, glamorous, charismatic, brilliant, slightly unscrupulous man. And he sees this beautiful girl dance for him and desires her. And when she sees the desire in his eyes, she sees that she has this one moment which can change her life. And in order to do it, she will have to break her husband's heart. But if she doesn't do it, then the moment of possibility will pass and she will be trapped in her little world for the rest of her life. So she takes the decision to go.
Now, she's in a dance which tells a classic story of the stealing, the robbing of a virgin and the attempt to bring her back. And as I was reading, I thought, of course, of Helen of Troy, who comes from a Western source. What is the dance that they are enacting?
Well, actually, the story of Helen of Troy, the story of the Trojan War, is parallel to the story of the Indian, great Indian classic, the Ramayana, the story of the abduction of the wife, Sita, the wife of Prince Ram, by the demon king, many-headed demon king, Ravan, who abducts her to his kingdom, Lanka, which we would now think of as Sri Lanka, and a war has to be fought to get her back. So the structure is not unlike the structure of the story of the Trojan War. There are ethnographers who try to argue that the two stories may have some common root somewhere lost in the mists of time of the beginnings of the Aryan migrations from Central Asia. And that dance is a traditional dance.
Because as I read, I thought, not only do you say that all places have become versions of the same place, but I began to think that one of the messages that underlies a good number of these books is that all of our stories are the same story. It just depends on which side of the mirror you're sitting on. Interpretation is what makes these stories different.
Yeah, I mean, when I was writing The Ground Beneath Her Feet, I did a lot of digging around into this subject about the common sources of mythology, you know, and there are essays, scholarly essays written suggesting that the Greek sky god Uranus might be in fact the same god as the Hindu sky god Varuna. Even the names you can hear, you know, have a kind of etymological relationship. And that, as I said, even these ancient stories, which are the roots of our civilizations, might once have been the same story, you know, which as they moved across the world varied. And I do think that it's a thing that I didn't used to worry away at so much. You know, when I wrote Midnight's Children that you kindly mentioned, I really wasn't consumed with this idea that the stories of the East and the West are somehow interpenetrated. And of course, you know, if the way in which they're interpenetrated in Midnight's Children is that the subject of colonialism is there, the British Empire was there, and the aftermath of the empire, you know, leaves behind a residue. But I didn't feel the need when writing Midnight's Children to connect the story of India and Pakistan to the stories of the rest of the planet. You know, and what's happened to me as I've gone on writing is, and as the world has changed, over the last 25 years, is that I've come to feel that partly because of mass migration, partly because of globalization, partly because of such things as international terrorism, you know, that our stories have now meshed so deeply that in order to understand one bit of the story, you have to understand others. You know, there's on the very first page of Midnight's Children, there's a moment at which Salim says, to understand me, just the one of me, you have to swallow the world, a kind of Whitman-esque statement. And at the time, he was being rhetorical. You know, now I'm sort of rather afraid that he might have been, the meaning of that sentence might be literal. To understand one life in one place, at one time, one event. You know, the murder in this book, with which the book begins, is a murder taking place essentially on King's Road in West Hollywood. You know, and to understand that murder, you have to literally swallow the world.
Travel the world. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Salman Rushdie, author most recently of Shalimar the Clown, published by Random House. We'll continue after this short break. Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Salman Rushdie about his new novel, Shalimar the Clown. In the commentaries and reviews of this book, they speak as if the parallel to Romeo and Juliet were an explanation. If only it were the Montagues and the Capulets. Mm-hmm. There's a huge difference here. What's happened in this world is that the plague on both of their houses is not, you know, Mercutio is joking. He's a staggering drunkard joker. And yes, a plague on both their houses is a dismissal. It's not an imprecation or a curse. Here we're watching the falling apart of the house of culture.
Yeah. I mean, a civilized thing is made uncivilized. You know, a place where the Montagues and the Capulets opposed the union of Romeo and Juliet. You know, I mean, the villagers in my story support it.
That's right.
And the snake that enters Eden is not to do with the blind rivalry unto death, you know, of two clans. You know, it has to do with the greed of nations for possession of a tiny, beautiful place, you know, and between those two nations, greedy in their different ways, the civilization of the place has no chance, really.
Well, essentially, in Midnight's Children, you say that the formation of India, or the formation of a nation, rivals those two other impossible mythologies, the mythology of money and the mythology of God, and that here, too, we're watching the possibility of an economic breakthrough for the poor dancer who sees that her future is foreclosed by the Valley of Kashmir. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, it's not that she's entering a world that she has no access to. What we're watching is her being denied access to that world. She's kept in a hotel room. She's fed with sweets. She's made, as many of your characters do, bloat and shrink. She's made hugely large. She's taken from an actual living thing and proclaimed by her village when she returns to be a ghost, and it's not just one set of people or another who are acknowledging her death in life. Everyone now shuns her. And we watch as Shalimar, in fact, does enter. She does not enter that world of things denied her. He does. And it's in the course of his education as a terrorist that he travels the world, that he is given access to other cultures. This becomes like a terrifying joke in this book, almost one that you dare to laugh at, because a fairly gentle, acrobatic, comedic character, broken by passion, is now taking willy-nilly instruction to be on a side of whatever dispute is presented to him.
Yes, that's right.
He's there in Korea. He's there as he travels. What he's learning is to be as ruthless a killer as he has been perfect as an acrobat, that it is something that has to do with perfection, mm-hmm. not with passion.
That's right. And as in the word, the famous line from the Bhagavad Gita, he says, "I have become death," you know, which is the line, of course, also famously quoted by Oppenheimer on the day that the first nuclear bomb was exploded. But I think that is the thing that, you know, I've always been interested in writing about characters who change a lot, you know, who go through a large metamorphosis in the course of their lives. And one of the things that happened in the making of this book was that I started out with the image of this murder. At a later point of the development of the planning of the book, I remembered having met a troupe of traveling players in Kashmir, not unlike the ones in the book. And the things came together, and I thought how interesting it would be if he were in this troupe of traveling players, who I remembered as being incredibly sweet-natured and touching as I tried to portray them. And if he were then to go through this amazing transformation into something very dramatically different, how would that happen? What would it mean to the human spirit that such a change could take place? You know, how can a man change so much? You know, and that was really the question I set myself. And
something very unusual happens here, because I was led to think of what Gatsby says about his love for Daisy. He says it was just personal.
Mm-hmm.
By the time you get to the end of this book, you're witnessing a crime that seems to signal an international incident, but in another way is just personal. Now, this is a moment at which this book seems to have some kind of false bottom or camouflaged contraption. That is to say, have we been witnessing, in terms of global politics, the consequences of things that are in fact just personal?
Well, I think there are ways in which we have. You know, I think if you look at a character like Osama bin Laden, here is a child, one of dozens and dozens of children of a father who was kind of absentee, you know. And if you look at what it is that's pushed him towards wishing to be so avenged on the world, you know, I think you could do worse than look at the psychology of being a child without a father, you know, as a starting place, or what it's like to be one of the brats of a harem, you know. People go down roads for all kinds of reasons, not all of which are the result of PhD theses in Middle Eastern studies. You know, in Kashmir, for example, a number of people go down the path of the jihadists simply because they need a paycheck, you know, because the economy of the valley is in ruins. They have children to feed. They have wives to look after. And even the small, pathetic paychecks they get, you know, are better than nothing. So people will sometimes become violent because to feed a child. Sometimes they'll become violent because of a sense of sexual betrayal and of having to watch your woman go off with another man more potent than you, more powerful than you, whose power you can never match as an individual. And so you find another kind of power. You know, or you reach for another kind of power in a way to decastrate yourself, you know. So, of course, people do things for personal reasons, you know, because personal is what we are. The point about Shalimar the clown and his motivations is this, that I came to feel that, okay, it's true, you know, history is true, the oppression is there, that the if you like, the ideological motives, you know, for his kind of violence are easy to see. You can see there they are, you know. But what they didn't explain to me is why him and not the person standing next to him, you know. Why is it that different men living in the same place, subject to the same pressures, having the same oppressions, feeling the same things about those, about their circumstances, do not all become violent men. You know, why is it he who makes that choice, whereas his neighbor would not? You know, and the answer to that is not allegory. The answer to that is the oldest novelistic answer of all, which is psychology. It's character. You know, something deep inside him could be triggered by historical events and unleash in him that capacity. That thing absent from his neighbor could not be triggered. And therefore, however angry or frustrated or resentful the neighbor might feel, he would not become a violent man. You know, so in the early, very early in the novel, Shalimar the clown, having just made love for the first time to the woman, the girl he loves, says to her in this kind of adolescent way, you know, don't leave me or I'll kill you. And, you know, if you have children with somebody else, I'll kill the children too. You know, this kind of testosterone-fueled remark, which she makes light of, you know, and says what a romantic you are. And you say the sweetest thing.
So sweet.
But I think for us reading the book, you know, there's an indication there that there is something bubbling in him, you know, and that had his life been different, had history been kinder to him, had she not betrayed him, then maybe that something would never have been triggered, you know, and he might have gone on being the person she describes as someone who would not hurt a fly. You know?
Well, in America in the late 60s and early 70s, that watch cry, the personal is the political, mm-hmm. came about. And this book seems to have an answer. The personal is and is not the political, and thereby hangs a tale.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think the personal is also just the personal, you know, and the political is also just the political, and there are points at which they cross and meet. And that, I mean, if I had to find a way of describing what I've been doing for the last, you know, three decades, it is to find how they meet, where they intersect, and what are the consequences of that intersection.
I've been speaking with Salman Rushdie, author most recently of Shalimar the Clown, published by Random House. Thank you, Salman, for joining me again.
Thanks, as always.
You can read an excerpt from Shalimar the Clown on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.